Hello and welcome to this week's episode of The Wagon with me, Finty Williams, and my friend and colleague, John McEwan. Our podcast is where we aim to lessen the stigma and shame of addiction and alcoholism. This week, we are absolutely delighted to be joined by the amazing Simon Day. Simon started his career 28 years ago, is that right?
Yeah, sounds about right.
Where you won the Time Out New Act of the Year award.
Yeah, it was about a year after I started, I won that. So
that's amazing.
All downhill.
28 years.
Yeah, incredible, isn't it?
You've been on television in pretty much everything, but I have to say my favourite, The Fast Show.
Thank you.
Which was a big, big part of our week in our house. And also, you were in a film with my mother.
That's
right,
I was.
You were in Shakespeare in Love, probably the best scene in the entire film.
That's right.
And you've written your own autobiography.
Yes, that was a few years ago, yeah.
Called Comedy and Error, They Really Were Marvellous Times.
Yeah, that was one of my catchphrases, Tommy Cockles. So actually, the editor came up with the title. So I thought it was a good title, that. Couldn't think of a title. It's the hardest thing, isn't it?
I guess it is, yeah. Well, as maybe people listening know, just to introduce myself, John McEwan, I'm an addictions counsellor, therapist, and I've worked in the business for a long time, over 30 years. And as Fincy's already introduced, we're aiming to just hopefully help people, especially people who may have a problem who are listening to this, who are maybe stuck and caught in that kind of cycle of not really knowing what to do. And through inspiring stories like yourself, we're hoping that people might, feel more able to reach out and get some help. And so when did it start, Si? When did you, there was obviously a time, which we'll get to, where you either knew yourself or somebody tapped you on the shoulder and said, listen, you've got a problem. But before that, did it start off with fun? Was it all about relaxing?
My parents broke up when I was 15, which is obviously a bad time. And one minute I was reading Tintin books, next minute I was living in a squat. And the drinking and sort of taking drugs recreationally, that wasn't really a problem. I sort of had a good time doing that, but I became addicted to fruit machines.
Mm.
And the seeds of that were, I used to go on holiday every year with my parents when I was young. And the last day, when you go to Devon, we'd go to the arcade and play all the penny falls and everything. And one year we didn't go. We didn't have time. And I remember being really crazy. I was so upset and I cried for, like half an hour. Mm. Looking back, I must have had some sort of attachment then. So all from 16 right up to sort of 23, 24, I was addicted to fruit machines and they kind of shut me off, from girls. I'd lose all my money. My friends would take me to different pubs. They'd say, let's go to a pub without a fruit machine because you'll lose all your money.
So your friends already were aware of what was going on.
And I eventually stole. I would be living miles away from the pub. I'd get a bus to the pub. I'd have sort of £6 or £5 and you work out your beer money, 32p a pint. And I'm not going to play them tonight. Bang, lose it all. Mm. And then you'd be borrowing money, which then would be, that's the first sort of shame.
Yeah.
And, people, I remember a guy said, do you want a pint? And I said, no, can I have a sandwich instead? I mean, stuff like that. And you're thinking, what am I saying? I spent all my money. I'm an idiot. And you get that sort of cycle of shame and addiction. And I ended up stealing to play fruit machines as a sort of, I couldn't live with either of my parents. And that was all kind of worries
me. That was going on in the background psychologically.
Yeah, I was really upset about that, but trying to sort of tough it out, obviously. And, my friends were going to university. I was like, why am I not at university? Why am I working as a labourer and signing on and sleeping on people's sofas? And I wound up going to Ballstall because I would literally go to my friend's house, have a joint, or they'd go and make a cup of tea. I'd nick a tenner and sometimes literally walk over the road and put it in the fruit machine. So I was kind of in it, totally gone.
Real in the grip, as they say.
There's no difference from being, a crackhead or someone who's on an opiate who's totally gone and just is in their own world. I was kind of in my own world.
I can just sort of interrupt there because we're now seeing the gambling. you know, with all the online stuff, the adverts. So I think it's really relevant that you obviously that you're sharing this, because back then there were only fruit machines. It wasn't online gambling. Yeah.
It wasn't seen as gambling, was it, really?
No, really seen as problematic.
No.
I knew all about the machines and I'd help people. It's funny because I wound up doing a sketch about it in the Fast Show, but I've talked to a guy who works at a rehab centre, and he says that a lot of the footballers, they can't see the connection between the other addictions. They go, oh, drugs is dirty. You know, I'll just have a bet. And they say, look, you lost your house.
Yeah.
And they go, yeah, but it's not like taking drugs. And they go, well, if you've lost your house, you know. And so it's very dangerous gambling, you know, because it's kind of, it's not seen as being sort of dirty and dark and sort your life out, get your act together. Mm. It's very easy to do. You know, later on in my life, when I was earning a lot of money before the kids, I got involved with the fixed odds betting terminals machines. Right. Yeah, and I started losing a lot of money on them. And at the time I could afford it, I was doing an ad campaign. But it was, you know, if you have a binge and you turn your phone off and you're out for 2 days, you've got 25 calls from the missus and, you know, you've missed a you're going to be doing a voiceover, whatever. With the gambling, you go in there, you lose it, boom, 400 quid. And I'll be eating my dinner thinking, I lost 500 quid today. Mm. Do you know what I mean? And it's, so it's very dangerous, I think, especially with the online stuff now. And I would meet all these people and they go, oh, I do a bit of poker online now. I do all right. And I'm thinking, everyone's doing all right. Someone's got to be losing. Yeah. Do you know what I mean? So, yeah, that's kind of, I don't bet now. I don't, you know, I don't go in a book. I don't have any kind of online sort of gambling thing.
Mm. So you're talking about that being your first addiction, really, then. And then obviously the ways and means to get more.
Yeah.
And then did it progress into alcohol and other substances? Was that related to work and social stuff, or was that something you just
did I kind of never had any money, so I was kind of just like surviving. You know, I always say that all I did between the ages of sort of 16 to sort of 30 was get good at pool. That was kind of it. You know, I used to read books. I had flats. I had the odd relationship, but I kind of was always slightly in my own world, and at the age of 29, they weren't really sort of desperate years in a sense. You know, I always had a job and I didn't get any money, but I wasn't like I was with the gambling and homeless. Mm. And I'd kind of sort of, I didn't make a connection between the 10 years after that. You see what I mean? I smoked a lot of dope. Everyone did. You know, I went and saw bands, magic mushrooms. I didn't see myself as having a drug problem. Mm. And then when I started doing the comedy, which happened very quickly, I instantly started taking coke, you know, immediately. It was almost like I'd been waiting to do that. You know, it's like most people sort of think, well, I've got a chance here with my career. Let's focus on the career. I sort of focused on taking drugs, you know, and I would go to, I would research them and obsess about them. Let's get some really good coke. You know, this coke's no good. And I would binge and I would work that round my career. And luckily, I never really had a sort of, I never sort of did lots of films in a row where you get found out. I'd do the Fast Show. We'd do one series a year, a few specials, and I'd do a few gigs. And I did a few gigs massively hungover, but I kind of survived it. You know, I got by, but that I then binged, you know.
Do you think that's something you would have got into had your career not taken off?
I was thinking about it the other day, and I don't know, because I was kind of like so desperate at 29. I was like, what are you going to do? You know, I was depressed, really.
Mm.
You know, looking back, so when it happened, I was just so sort of happy. The binging didn't really bother me that much at first, because I'm on telly, you know, I'm earning loads of money. And I had nothing since I left home. From the age of 16 to sort of 30, I was earning some 100 quid a week, or signing on, or borrowing tenors. I was kind of that guy you'd lend a fiver to and I'd never pay you back. So for a long time, it was kind of all right. It was like, you know, I had a suit, so I was going out and girlfriends and blah, blah. So it didn't. And then it just became, you know, it says in the book, sick and tired of being sick and tired. You know, I just can't keep on doing this. You know, you try all the, I won't drink tonight. If I don't drink, I won't do it. So in the end, you just have enough. It wasn't, I didn't really know anything about recovery in South East London. No one ever mentioned it to me, you know, until I got to, my wife lived in Notting Hill and I moved there with her. And that's a big recovery area around there. And I started to know people who are in recovery and like, okay, maybe this is a thing, you know. And I went to my first meeting there. 2001.
Wow.
Yeah.
And what was it like realizing? I mean, two things. One, clearly that you had a problem, and two, hang on, there might be some help available here.
Yeah, it was great. I didn't, you know, I went in there, you know, I was earning a lot of money. I thought I was, you know, this great sort of talented sort of maverick person. All my heroes were sort of like were dead. Tony Hancock, Peter Sellers. I definitely thought in my mind there was a link between being creative and caning it, you know. And it was pathetic, really. And so I went into my first NA meeting. I really enjoyed it. I came back and went to my wife. Yeah, this is great. But then I read the thing saying you can't drink. And I was like, what? You know? Mm-hmm. And because when I went in there thinking I'm a cokehead and Coke's making me do all these terrible things, right? When I just have a drink, I'm fine, you know. And I remember thinking, well, I can't drink. And that really bothered me, you know. So then I just kept bouncing in and out, just drinking on holiday. I'd get 6 months and then I'd go, oh, I can have a drink.
And again, different people talk about this in different ways, don't they? We've talked about it, we're all in recovery here. And it's that like anesthetic. It's like we have to have something.
Yes.
There's we can let go of this particular drug because that's problematic, or even that particular spirit because that's a problem.
Mm-hmm.
But we've got to have something. And
it's like a reward, isn't it?
Yeah. And again, I suppose without going off on too much of a tangent, you've talked about the early life stuff, the problems in your life. Do you think it was, you know, or your addiction in general maybe was about medicating, self-medicating to cope?
Yeah, I think I was born with massively over-inflamed emotions which I couldn't cope with. You know, addiction for me is A, negative thinking.
Mm.
You know, wake up. Mm. You might be feeling good, but the other side, there'll be 50-50 negative thoughts coming in. Oh, got to do that. You know, everything's... Yeah, to me, it's like being a big baby. Oh, I've got to do that. Oh, the traffic's going to be terrible. Oh, God.
That's such a good way to put it.
You know what I mean? It's that. It's the negative thinking and, you know, projecting, dealing with normal life. Right. For me, I was always... I was like, my mate said, you're either starving or you feel sick. You know, everything's boring. What are we going to do? Nothing happens. It's, you know, I can't bear... I started being a comedian. One, because I wanted people to like me. And I felt like a weirdo. I used to wet the bed and I was a late developer. And, you know, my dad was posh and my mum was working class. And I just felt like a sort of... It was actually the wetting the bed, which was the first thing. As someone said to me in the recovery, it's the first shame, that cycle of shame. Yeah. Why have you wet the bed? I don't know. What's wrong with you? What is wrong with me? You know, I mean, I used to nick stuff and nick sugar and eat all the Mars, but all the club biscuits my mum bought. But there's kind of a... There's kind of a romance around that. But with bed wetting, it was like, there's something wrong with you. So I was always had that in the back of my head, you know, that there's something slightly wrong about you. And I used to just read. I couldn't really deal with people. I just couldn't deal with sort of normal relationships. It was kind of either really good or really bad. I was really happy or really sad. Just remember, you know, boredom, anything sort of flat and calm, and I've got to do something. I've got to read, or I've got to watch telly, or I've got to go and climb a tree, or, you know, normal life, I suppose.
Yeah. That's what some people call the ism, isn't it, I guess, in a way that there's a... I mean, we were talking earlier about ADHD, actually, and ADD and the link between addiction as well. That's probably for another episode even, but that kind of irritation, that kind of... inability to sit still and as you say, you're either focusing on the good, it's really brilliant, or it's really crap. So just going forward, I mean, how do you reconcile that? Because I think what you're saying is it's still with you. Is that right?
It's kind of, you know, gym meeting, those two things, you know what I mean?
So self-help groups is part of that.
I meditate as well.
And meditation.
Yeah, but I'm happiest when I'm working. Like I was filming a little while ago, and that's like great. They pick you up at 6:30. They keep giving you loads of food. It's not reality. the problem is they feed your narcissism, and then you come home and it's like you're the idiot in the house again. Your daughter's having a go at you, and your wife's saying, "Where's the? I told you, blah blah." So, but yeah, I'm happier when I'm working. Right. You know, I have to accept that I'm not particularly good with nothing to do. You know what I mean?
So that's part of your journey is being active, is, I guess, having a distraction, ideally a positive distraction.
Yeah, exactly, yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, yeah, the meditation helps a lot. That's helped me definitely calm me down. I'm sleeping a lot better. I go through periods of not sleeping, but that's kind of, I just have to accept that's me, really. I mean, the sleeping thing has gone nuts, isn't it? I read a thing the other day in The Guardian, like 40% of people can't sleep.
Yeah, yeah.
Which is a lot of that's to do with devices and phones and...
Yeah, which then, of course, leads to people taking substances to help them get to sleep.
Yeah.
In many cases.
Yeah,
Finty often talks about, because she's an actress, performing, you know, performing in post-addiction. How do you cope with that sort of stuff when you're having to perform?
Yeah, I mean, when I first started doing stand-up, not drinking, that was difficult. I like to sort of be on my own before I perform. I don't go in the audience and say, well, where are you from and all that, and are you married to him? So, you know, this is another thing. Performing for me, because people go, oh, God, how do you do it? I could never do what you do. It's dark. The room is pitch black. Spotlight's on me. I can't see anyone. And I give an address. I'm not communicating with the people. And then I go back and then I go home. I might come out and sign a book or whatever. But that's, again, even the job I've chosen has got to do with not being good with people, I think. Right. I'm wanting to sort of be adored, but not actually having to deal with reality. Because normal people don't go and stand in a pub and try and make people laugh over and over again, you know. If you ever want to go to Edinburgh and get in a room with, like, 8 comics, then you'll go, wow. So, you know, what is wrong with these people?
It's very interesting. I've said it on numerous occasions. You know, people say, why are you an actress? And I said, because I can spend 3 hours a night not being me.
Yeah, exactly.
You know, it's great.
Yeah.
Suddenly I can walk out in front of 800 people and I'm not an alcoholic. I'm not in recovery. Yeah. I'm not scared. I'm not short or overweight or any of those things, which are the things that keep you up at 4 o'clock in the morning and say you're not good enough. You know, and it's really interesting to hear you say that because you don't hear many people say that.
No, but and they say, and you know, it's like that speech in Magnificent Seven. And he goes, oh, the kid's watching him shoot the people. And he goes, I want to be like you. He said, no, your father's a real man. He works. And to me, I always think those people that earn 16 grand a year, I used to meet people and they'd earn sort of 18 grand a year and they'd have a house and they'd go on 2 holidays and a car and a garage and they'd mend things. Mm. And I used to think, how do they do it? You know. Because it's like I did all that stuff, jobs and everything, but to me I just couldn't. The worst thing was the people. You know, unless they were characters. When I was young it was fine, but as you get older, I see people in offices with just these little partitioned offices with 3 pictures and a computer. I just think, how do you do that? Yeah, it terrifies me. Yeah. Not demeaning anything to do with that kind of life. Mm. I wish I could do it, but I couldn't do it.
Do you see it as a maintenance thing that you have to stay on top of? Even though you don't drink and take drugs anymore, do you see it as work in progress?
It's always, yeah. And the people, all the people I know are really long term clean, and I'm not. I've relapsed a lot through not doing the program and not going to meetings. Every time I've relapsed, it's been, why you've not been to any meetings? You know, you've been abroad.
Kept up your support.
Yeah, you know, I think that's very important. Mm. You can't take your eye off the ball. Sadly, I wish you could. Because there's hundreds of people all around you going, but you don't need to do it anymore, do you? Or you're not really an alcoholic. You don't drink a bottle of whiskey and fall on the floor. So the more time you spend with the normal people, there's all these little sort of nudges the wrong
way. And
that's
the unfortunate thing is that with the work comes that attitude.
Yeah.
You know, so you have the high of doing the work and all of that. And then afterwards you go to the pub and because of the profession that we're in, you know, you go to the pub at the end of the day or you go to the pub after the show and inevitably somebody will say, what do you want to drink? You say Diet Coke and they look at you as though you'd just fallen from Mars.
Exactly.
You know, and they go, what do you mean? You could have one.
Yeah.
No, I can't.
Go on.
No, but it's dealing with those people, but it's also dealing with the feeling of the high of coming off stage or, you know, coming away from filming or something like that. And it's teaching yourself how to not congratulate yourself with a drink.
Yes. Mm. When you've done a gig, you're really hyped up. And suddenly I was out in the street, sort of sweating, sort of stuffing a wig into a bag like I'd done a robbery. And then you're like, what do I do now? You know what I mean? And I find there was some opiate to bring me down, you know, because it takes a while to come down. Like if you do a theatre job, I used to come off, and then you start thinking, well, I can't go to the rat party, and they're all going to have a pint. And if someone comes to see you, they want to go and have a drink. So it is difficult. And the more, as you say, the more time you spend going, yeah, it's not fair, I wish I could have a pint now, you know, other people will go, well, can't you? You've got to try and...
Yeah.
You know what I mean? Be with people who understand.
And do you tend to tell people?
Yeah, I have no problem with it. I never understood that when people say, oh, so-and-so's in, he's going to meet, but don't tell anyone. I'm like, but I saw him at 3 a.m. the other day, sort of like sweating with a nosebleed. I mean, people can see him like that, and then they're embarrassed about, I don't, you know what I mean? I've never had a problem with saying I don't drink, I don't smoke, I'm in recovery, whatever. Mm. And they say the more people know about it, the better.
That is such a peculiar thing, isn't it?
Yeah.
That we're very fine and open about being in pubs for hours on end, talking to people we don't know, drinking too much, spending money that we don't have, behaving in a way that we would never dream of doing. Yeah. But then you get well and you battle all of that and then you get ashamed of saying that you're well.
Yeah.
Such a peculiar thing to me.
I don't know. I think it's difficult because then you've got to try and... I think if you say... Then you've got to explain it. And I think even when I used to binge, you know, I used to be in my flat thinking, liven yourself up, go and have a bath, you know. Come on, this is ridiculous. And that's the old ethos, what I grew up with. You'd be all right, do you know what I mean? It's like if your son is injured playing football, you're like, God, get on with it. And the modern way now is, well, he could be hurt, you know, take him off and give him this and he's fine, get him back on. So I had that going on. And then the other part of me thinking, no, I'm done in here. This is not normal, you know. I'd ring people up myself, I went up for 3 days and they go, oh, everyone does it. And I think they don't, do they? No. Everyone doesn't do it. We do, our little gang of 20 people, but we're not normal. You know, I don't want to feel like this anymore. I don't want to do these things that I wouldn't possibly think of doing. I might think of doing them, but I don't do them, you know, straight. And I think it's difficult to explain that.
So, Simon, having been through that recovery process, the process of rehabilitation, and now you're in social situations where you're not partaking in those things, what's it like looking around the room? Do you kind of overanalyze people? Do you count people's drinks for them? What's it kind of like?
Yeah, I do sort of notice it. Generally, you can tell because people start talking to you and they'll go, well, you don't drink? And you go, no. You go, what, not at all? And you go, no. Oh, right, okay. Why is that then? And you go, well, I just don't drink anymore. You know, I've got a bit too much for me. And they go, okay. But not even at Christmas. So, you know what I mean? It's like my friend, a friend of mine, his mum and dad were publicans, the sort of Surrey publicans, and he said, I've given up drink, mum. And she went, have you what, completely? She went, yeah. And he goes, oh, does that mean you can only drink beer? So, you know, it's ingrained. But I don't really go out drinking, so I don't really see a lot of people. But I do notice it, yeah, you can tell.
And do you feel lonely? Do you feel odd? Do you feel... Or not anymore?
What, in terms of that?
In terms of you're not kind of, you know, as we know, the volume goes up, doesn't it?
Mm.
As people drink more and they seem to laugh more and they seem... And sometimes when you're the sober
one
in the room...
No, in those situations, yeah, I find the trouble is that it's all right at first, but you can't match their enthusiasm. Yes. That's the problem. And once they've had a few drinks, champagne's the worst because you get a little bit of champagne sick breath on you. So they're really excited about nothing. And you're going, right, yeah. And I'm pretty doer anyway. So you're like, yeah, really? Okay. Then you're going, I'm going to go and stand over there now. That's the thing. Right, I'm just going to go and stand over there. And you'll see, then you are trapped because you're not...
Mm. And then you just slip off sometimes.
Yeah, I had to watch the slipping off because I try and slip off before I've even got there.
Okay.
My son, because he's very like me and my son, we used to go to these kids' parties with these really loud DJs going, all right, kids, how are you? And he'd get there at the door and go, let's go, Dad. And I was thinking, I can't use his, do you know what I mean? But I'd say, no, go on, you go and play. We'll just have 10 minutes. Yeah. I'm not mad. Yeah, I don't really do it a lot, though. I don't go out, you know, I'll go out to eat.
Mm.
I don't go, you know, I try not, as I say, with the gigs, you know, I'll go to the bar afterwards and maybe say, well, thanks. But yeah, that's probably the hardest thing.
And that kind of, I don't know, maybe we shouldn't call it an awakening, if some people might, but that kind of transition into the benefits of sobriety, the benefits of, of not, as you say, having those 3-day binges.
Yeah.
Where do you see the goodies in that? I mean, you've kind of touched on it a bit, but where are your goodies of not doing those old things?
Well, when I was using, I'd always be thinking, oh God, I shouldn't have done that. I've got to hide that bill. I've got a credit card bill or a phone bill, which, you know, I've got to get that, make sure I can get that. I've got to buy that. Do you know what I mean? So you're constantly... That's why I think a lot of addicts are good at acting and doing that stuff, because they've always got an interior monologue going on. Mm. And so for them to go and perform, it's not that hard, because they've always had this interior monologue driving them nuts, and they can switch and just talk to people while they're thinking, fuck, I've got to go and get that. I've left it upstairs, that's half a bottle of wine up there. Yeah. You know, behind this thing, I've got it. You know what I mean?
Yeah.
So none of that. That's
yeah.
gone.
Yeah.
So it's just a straight, you know, path. Obviously, there are things that are difficult. If you hang around with people in recovery, that really helps me to do that. You know, I go to the gym, I get a good night's sleep most of the time. And I don't feel like I'm kind of, I've done something wrong. I don't feel half, I'm not acting at sort of 55% or 35%. Yeah. You know, because the thing about addiction is I used to go in there and I'd see these people that had just sort of fallen very quickly, and they'd been intravenous drug users, and they went right down, they were going to die, and then they got clean, and then now 20 years. And that wasn't really my story. I kept going in and out, and I'd go back and go, yeah, but they're all really, you know, they need to be in there. I don't. You know what I mean? I was deluded for a long time. Mm. I'm okay. I'm on telly, and, you know, look at my shoes. You know, they're all, you know, because I used to see all these people really calm and recovery, sort of just with sandals on. They go, hi, how are you feeling? And I go, all right. You know what I mean? Like, what do they know? You know what I mean? And then you realise that the longer you stay in it, the less you worry about where you're going to be and with what people you're going to be with and getting that. You know, I have to watch Obsession a bit.
Nice.
When I'm clean, I've got to get that camera, and, you know, if I get that camera
saw that on Twitter,
with that lens and all that, you know, it's kind of... So, yeah, obsessive thinking, something I have to watch.
But it sounds like you've got, again, whether we call it an internal dialogue or a better sense of self, that you can soothe yourself a bit more now, that you're not so hard on yourself, even for being obsessive, even for making mistakes or whatever.
Well, you go to a meeting and you hear other people talking and you go, oh, you know, I went the other night and there were three guys all... I hear a lot of men talking about moaning in the house that they've got. Like a guy said, my wife works, she came home, she cooked me a lovely meal, she made a sauce, she had a lovely fish, and she made a pudding. And then she said, oh, can you pour me some water? And I was like, oh God, can't you pour her own water? So it's kind of, it doesn't describe a very good, if you're thinking of going out with an addict in recovery, you're basically going to go out with a kid. So I have to fight the grumpiness as well, and natural sort of grumpiness. Again, I have to go to a meeting for that.
Yeah. So that's the maintenance again, keeping an eye on that side of you, if you like.
Yeah, and then your head might go, oh, it was all right when I was drinking. I needed to get, you know, if I had a drink, I'd be okay. I wouldn't be grumpy.
Yeah.
You know what I mean? So you have to watch all those thought processes.
Yeah, yeah. Well, we're in the last 5 minutes, believe
wow.
it or not.
Goodness me.
It's gone really quickly. I mean, I kind of wanted to touch on the shame, but I know that will mean that we'll probably run out of time, but I think... You know, you and other guests, and I too, and I know Finn's touched on that kind of, some of that kind of internal shame we have from the past. Maybe we're shamed. And I think a lot of people kind of who deal with addiction problems, and actually it's not just addiction problems, you know, shame is something. Have you done particular work on that, on some of those things?
Well, I don't know. I wrote it all out and I sort of said it in front of loads of people, you know.
Right. Well, and that sort of freed it up.
It seemed to, yeah. It seemed to help me a lot, yeah. I don't, you know.
Is it still the thing I get at 4 o'clock in the morning, you know, where you can't sleep and you think you're the only person awake in the world?
I had that last night. I'm not going to sleep tonight. And it's that projection. I'm not going to sleep. And I went and got in the spare room and then I had a cup of tea and, you know, and I thought, I haven't got to be there till 11. Mm. I mean, in the old days, I used to go straight to work without any sleep.
Yeah,
that was not pleasant.
No.
I could have carried on for ages.
Yeah,
well, I'm
talking
about myself for a long time.
Oh, it's great.
Thank you so much for coming in. It really is. Particularly pertinent today, we can't finish without saying a big thank you to Abitha Calm, a residential clinic specialising in addictions and mental health. Without their support, this podcast would not have been possible. You can find out more about their fabulous work at www.ebithacom.com. Thank you so much.
No worries. Thank you very much.
And if you've enjoyed the show, please subscribe. And if you really liked us, then please give us 5 stars.
And tell all your friends about
us. And tell all your mates.
All your friends.
Please.